This is an interview with Carl Barnicle for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby. Today is June 3rd, 2013, and our interview is being conducted at Mr. Barnicle's home in St. Louis, Missouri. Mr. Barnicle, thank you for being with us today.
Pleased to help.
I think it's we should start with your early life and education. Where are you from originally?
Chicago. I'm a lonely Cubs fan in Cardinals Nation.
And did you grow up with any interest in law or economics or business?
I had an interest in law from early on because I can't point to anything in particular that pushed me in that direction.
Okay. And so you did your undergrad at Johns Hopkins?
That's right.
And what did you study as an undergrad?
Political science.
Is there
which
any...
at the time I thought was preparation for law school. It isn't, but it's fine.
And so you knew the whole time you were planning on going to law school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you did your law work at the University of Chicago?
Right.
How did you come to be at the University of Chicago?
Oh, I mean, a combination of ingredients, but, you know, partly it was, I thought maybe it was time to go back to Chicago. I had other places I could go, but I thought it was time to go back there.
And were there any, while you were in law school, were there any courses or mentors that shaped your direction?
Oh, I don't know that. I don't know that there's anybody in particular. There's two professors that stand out. One was a young man named Dallin Oaks, D-A-L-L-I-N, Oaks, who had quite a resume then. He'd been a clerk to Chief Justice Warren, and he'd had another clerkship before that. And by this time he was a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He was from Salt Lake City, and ultimately he went back to Salt Lake City. First, as I recall, he became president of Brigham Young. Then he was a justice, or maybe the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Utah. And then he became one of the 12 elders of the Mormon Church. And he was just a superb... He was a guy who had a lot of interest in the students and just, you know, it wasn't so much intellectual mentorship as it was just at a personal level. And the second professor that sticks with me, I mean, there were a lot of notable ones, a man who's still alive named Phil Neal. He was the dean, but he was also the professor of antitrust. Let's come back to antitrust because I know this is about the SEC, but there's some stuff that was going on about the same time that I think is relevant.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that now, if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
The antitrust matters you mentioned.
Well, you had a question on the outline. Did the work of the Chicago economists ever intersect with the law school studies?
Yes.
They did, and it was on purpose.
Okay.
Because this was the early days of law and economics, and one of the one of University of Chicago's claim to fame then and now was the development of the law and economics concepts. In the antitrust course, they brought in one day a week. A man named Ronald Coase. Coase is still alive. He's 101, and he just co-authored another book. Unbelievable. Okay, he had a collaborator, but you know he's an author and he's still publishing stuff at 101. All right. Now I have to tell you that a lot of what Coase had to say at the time went over my head. I mean. But the basic concepts about law and economics that stuck with that you know did start to make a dent, and the one incident that really stuck with me was this is also the antitrust course. Dean Neal after we'd gone through a bunch of merger cases, says, all right, now what's the common factor in all these cases? Okay, so, you know, various people put up their hands and think they've figured out what the common factor is, and they propose what the common factor is, and he demolishes it, okay? You know, no, that's wrong, and he can immediately explain why you're out of your mind, you know, you're way off the mark, okay? So he goes through four or five of these people trying to propose common themes to these cases, and he can knock them all down. And he finally says, you haven't figured out what's the common theme in all these cases. The common theme is the government won every single one of them, even though there is no common economic theory, there is no common legal theory to any of them, okay, to this group, okay? Well, it stuck with me because starting in, and to me, the kind of early 80s is a watershed period, both in antitrust and in the securities law. And one minor claim to fame is having been one of the lawyers involved in a situation in 1981 where Conoco was being pursued in a hostile takeover situation by three different companies, Mobil Oil, DuPont, and a Canadian family. What's the liquor firm in Montreal run by the Bronfmans?
It's not ringing any bells.
Well, it's the big. It's a big Canadian liquor outfit, and they're.
Oh, Seagram's.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, so there were three people, and Seagram's had some industrial operations, but in any case, there were three companies pursuing Conoco. And our involvement at Monsanto was that we had a very large joint venture with Conoco. And we went to the Justice Department and said, if you let, you must impose a condition on DuPont that they buy us out of this joint venture, because if you don't, then they will be privy to all the information about our fibers business. Mm-hmm. And at the time, DuPont and Monsanto were the two biggest producers of particular types of nylon. Now, what happened was that Mobil bid higher than DuPont for Conoco, but DuPont got it because nobody at the time believed that the antitrust authorities would allow a big oil company like Mobil to acquire another big oil company like Conoco. Because of the way the thing was timed, DuPont got their clearance under Hart-Scott-Rodino ahead of Mobil. And as soon as they got the clearance, everybody tendered to DuPont. Mm-hmm. And they got it. Now, you know, like a week or 10 days went by, and I can't remember if it was Justice or the FTC, I think it was Justice, issued a letter that said, Mobil's okay too. But they'd lost it by then. It was all over, okay? That was... The reason that was significant was that was the first practical application of all of this law and economics work on an actual antitrust matter, okay? And it was because this was right after Reagan was in and there was a new head of the antitrust division, a guy, I think his name was Baxter, and he was from this law. He was out of that whole law and economics school, and he brought in a bunch of economists, and they all said, no, this is not really, you know, yeah, they're two big oil companies, but... There's all these other big oil companies, and it really isn't an issue. And so they let it go through. So, you know, that was a real watershed in antitrust, and allowed a lot of mergers to go forward that nobody would have dreamed possible based on the case law up to that point. All right? Mm-hmm. That feeds a lot of the merger activity that takes off in the 80s, okay? So I finally have gotten back to the securities laws and corporate governance and, you know, transactional work. But that fundamental change in the antitrust law, which, you know, there's ups and downs depending on whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, but the basic shift to a law and economics analysis of mergers comes with that Conoco, Mobil, DuPont case. And, you know, the merger activity takes off from that standpoint. Mergers among companies that you might have thought were competitors, okay?
Yeah.
And it's really the death of it, it, that case isn't the one that says it, but that's also the death of objection to mergers based on vertical integration, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's a few cases after that, but not many. It's almost, you know, it's pretty much dead.
Mm-hmm.
So this feeds all sorts of activity that wouldn't have been possible before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before that, what's the classic merger of the 60s? It's the conglomerate,
mm-hmm.
okay, which continues to some extent into the 70s. All right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a conglomerate. You can so all kinds of things become possible that nobody thought were possible before. Okay, long way around to sort of respond to your question about what was really influential in law school. Well, you know, and particularly the law and economics work, you know, 15 years later, you know, there it was.
Right.
I mean,
that generation of students has started to come into the...
Yeah, and the people who were really in charge at that time had been students a few years before me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all of a sudden this stuff really becomes the new operative rules. Okay.
So was antitrust your major focus in law school?
No, I don't know if I had a... I mean, I thought... When I was in law school, I thought I was going to go into real estate. That was ridiculous. Fortunately, it never happened.
So what did you do when you came out of law school?
I was an associate at Kirkland & Ellis in Chicago. Then I got... I mean, this is in the days of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up applying and getting into the Navy JAG program. So I went off in Navy JAG. And then when I came back, there was this kind of nifty-looking position with a subsidiary of Monsanto called EnviroChem in Chicago. So I went there. And then ultimately, you know, then after a couple of years, as all big corporations do, there was a shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
And the law department got shuffled, and I ended up here.
So when you started, I suppose, with EnviroChem, what were your responsibilities as a junior lawyer?
Oh, that was, I mean, that that was really primarily an engineering and construction operation that had certain proprietary technologies in the environmental area.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, most of the work was really had nothing to do with governance.
Okay.
It was engineering and construction, contract negotiation, and, you know, disputes, whatnot. You know, plus there is a kind of a regulatory world unto itself for engineers and contractors.
Right. And so after a couple of years, you ended up in the law department of Monsanto. Did you continue doing the same sorts of things?
No, I worked for 4 years, I think, with some different operations, primarily the commercial work and some transactional work for the parts of the Monsanto business that were involved in basic petrochemicals and plastics.
Okay. How did they have a big
plastics was a big business at that time.
Right. So at what point did you start to get involved more with the governance side of
things? That was, was it 75 or 76? I think it was 76.
Okay.
Yeah. I shifted to the corporate SEC group in the law department and started doing that sort of stuff.
Okay. What did that involve?
Oh, it was the annual cycle stuff, mm-hmm. right? 10-K proxy statement, annual meeting, and financing transactions primarily, and some transactional work. There was a big chunk of my time in the early years when I was working on this Conoco transaction that I told you, mm-hmm. where Monsanto goes to the Justice Department and says, you've got to force DuPont to buy us out because we can't be in the same joint venture, mm-hmm. okay? The joint venture, incidentally, by that time was a financial flop, okay? Mm-hmm. So we want it out. there was a beginning to that, which mm-hmm. dragged on and on, but a big chunk of time was spent putting together the Conoco joint venture in, 76, 77, occupied a big chunk of 77. When everybody thought this was the answer, so.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the sort of the process is of putting together the reports and filings, just kind of how it works from the internal side?
Oh, well, the proxy statement in Monsanto, and I think most large companies that have significant inside counsel, is usually kind of run by the law department. And you start out with a series of memorandum to everybody mm-hmm. who is in possession of information that has to be included in the proxy statement, and you run down a calendar to make sure you get everything in and it can be done in time to mm-hmm. whatever there's a calendar of deadlines, some of which are oriented around just the mechanics of printing it and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The 10-K is usually, I think, a joint effort by the accounting group, the controllers group, and the lawyers to pull the information together, since the accountants take the lead on the mm-hmm. obviously on the financial statements, because they've got to produce the financial statements for the year, and negotiate with the auditors about any issues there,
mm-hmm.
and then all the other stuff usually is pulled together by the law department, and integrating mm-hmm. the whole document.
One of the things I was curious about is that in the late 70s, especially in the wake of the corporate payment scandals, there's some
yeah.
new, yeah, it was there were some, that people started taking a new look at how corporations handled with the idea of internal controls and accounting controls and things
yeah.
like that. Was that something that you dealt with at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, we already had, even back then, a program for annual certification by all the management employees mm-hmm. of compliance with all the usual policies that were mm-hmm. in place at that point, which included antitrust and securities law compliance, no insider trading, mm-hmm. all the usual stuff, and all of those got revisited and beefed up in the mid 70s. I think most places. Just give you a thought with respect to your research.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk to somebody about this area,
mm-hmm.
at that time the defense contractors were the leaders
mm-hmm.
of, across. I mean, if you wanted the biggest and best compliance program in those days, you look to the defense contractors as the model, because they'd been hit, you know, with all the activities about $500 hammers and various bribery.
You mean in terms of reforming how things were done?
It just developing bigger, better internal procedures to ensure compliance with law, company policies. I'll just let it go.
Okay.
I think my wife's off somewhere.
Okay.
Monsanto was one of the companies that filed an 8K in 1976 with respect to questionable payments. And obviously at that point, you know, put in new policies to try to prevent that sort of activity. That was among the things that were done to beef up your compliance and your, you know, was getting a new program in place to capture that sort of activity. On your outline, you mentioned political contributions. I don't recall that was particularly an issue at Monsanto.
Okay.
Maybe I just... there were companies that had, you know, big political contributions in the, 72 election and things like that. The famous case is Arm & Hammer, right? Yeah, so.
Okay. And so at this point, are you yet the assistant corporate secretary, or does that come later? This is 76-77.
Tell you the truth, I don't know.
Okay. You said also that you were involved in the SEC practice. Did you interact with the commission very much, or?
Well, in the 70s, only on specific filings.
Okay.
In those days, you spent a lot of time negotiating reviews of S-8s, which are cover the benefit plans. I mean, it was a terrible waste of everybody's time. Unfortunately, that eventually went away. Then if you had financing or something, you'd probably have a more substantive review.
Okay. One of the things that you talked about was putting together the proxy statement. Were you involved in responding to shareholder proposals? Or
yes,
yes. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, the shareholder proposals in those days tended to be on social or political issues. I mean, we had a South Africa proposal every year. And I've blanked on what the rest of them were, but they really weren't governance issues.
Okay.
As it later.
So you didn't have very many proposals in terms like not trying to nominate director or seeking to nominate directors or
not back then.
Okay.
Not in that time. No. Meaning that Monsanto had a big enough profile that we would get shareholder proposals every year, but. As I say, my memory in the 70s, and you're going to ask me eventually at what point does it flop over to being more governance oriented, and I'll have to try to bring that back down. But at this point, no, they're not governance issues. What's going on in governance at this time that is significant, or at least perceived as significant, is you're shifting from a board of directors that is majority inside, to a board of directors that's mostly outside people, Now,
about
in the case of Monsanto, you can ask yourself whether this this made the this whether this made a difference or not, and I'll give you a kind of a ancient, more even older background story on this. When I got there, the board consisted of something on the order of 10 insiders and 4 outsiders. Okay, so you kind of think, well, the outsiders are insignificant, powerless. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, the 4 outsiders, right after I got there, got together and decided the CEO was not up to the job, mm-hmm. and they fired him. Mm-hmm. Now, there's 10 inside directors who were buddies of the CEO. Okay. You know, why didn't they vote this down? Well, mm-hmm. they didn't. On issues like this, the practical reality was that the 4 outsiders mm-hmm. Were in control. Okay? Up until that time, you know, being named to the board of directors was sort of like being knighted in Britain. You know, it was an honor, mm-hmm. and it was expected at a certain level. You know, and it's about this time, about mid-70s, that is no longer considered good governance, and companies just, you know, as insiders, they don't fire the insiders, mm-hmm. but they retire and they disappear, and they're always replaced with outsiders.
Was there something that was driving that, or was this just sort of something that companies realized was necessary?
I think it's the latter. I don't recall that there was some particular event that was driving it. Mm-hmm.
And where, in terms of looking for independent directors, were there characteristics? How did companies like Monsanto go about finding new independent directors?
You know, initially it's a fairly informal process. Mm-hmm. I mean, later on, people develop committees to go do this and
right.
hire search firms and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But at this point, it's pretty informal.
Okay.
And it really becomes a kind of, you know, there's a kind of agreed parameters for what we want in the nature of an outside director. Typically, the preference was to get somebody who was the CEO of another major company or a leading academic, you know, or sometimes a retired government official. We had some prestigious position. And so, you know, but, you know, it was, I think it was just kind of informal word of mouth process at that point.
Okay. Because there's not, at this point, there aren't the same requirements in terms of having a financial expert and things like that at this point.
No. I mean, in fact, about this time, one of the outside directors that is brought on is the CFO of IBM.
Okay.
Okay, well, he's a financial expert, sure enough. But nobody thought in those terms. They just thought, well, IBM's a really big company, and here's this guy who's the CFO. He must be mm-hmm. a real powerhouse, which he was. Mm-hmm. So
besides the shift to a more independent board, are there other issues from your early days involved in governance that you think of or that stand out to you as important?
Looking back, you know, the big event of that period is this fairly rapid shift mm-hmm. from majority inside to majority outside. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. But, you know, at least in the case of Monsanto, I'm not sure the practical effect was as great as you might expect, okay? Mm-hmm. Because, as I say, the 4 outsiders, going back to the early 70s, clearly when it came down to a really big decision, mm-hmm. called the shots.
Gotcha.
So, but I, you know, that mid-70s period, I think the shift from inside to outside, obviously is, I mean, obviously over the long haul, it makes a difference.
So the...
That's the big change of the mid-70s to me.
Mm-hmm. And that has much more impact than any of the reforms sort of pushed by either the SEC or the stock exchange or things.
Well,
like
there
that.
was a somewhere in that period we go through one of these cycles where they try to beef up the compensation disclosure, mm-hmm. and I think you can possibly argue about maybe some of the comp disclosure things that have come along lately. I don't know that I would make this claim for everything, but certainly the ones in the 70s and 80s the and early 90s where the comp disclosure was beefed up, I think the practical result was that compensation skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
More data?
Right.
Hey, we hadn't thought of that. Let's, you know, look what they're doing.
Right.
I mean, you know, a lot of you know, various people in Washington were pushing greater disclosure, and their hidden agenda was that they thought these people were being paid too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the practical result of more disclosure was higher compensation. Until, you know, as I say, I think you can argue about whether the last batch of these reforms had that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Because all through this period, every time there was a change, comp went up.
Because the data could be used to justify the higher pay?
Yeah, more data. You know, it wasn't that the stuff wasn't there before, but, you know, you didn't have the detail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you didn't have some of the, especially you didn't have the detail on some of the deferred comp stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, going forward into the 1980s, we talked a little bit already about the antitrust issues, but sort of more broadly with mergers and takeovers, was that something that you dealt with at Monsanto?
Yes. I mean, that you know, with the in the 80s, you get the beginning of the hostile takeovers,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
so yeah, that gets management's attention, and everybody gets excited about that.
Is it something that, in terms of, for example, like the takeover defenses, was that something that you all looked at?
Yeah. I think like many, many companies of our size, you know, you went through the analysis of, well, all right, what should we do? You know, in the initial phases of this, of course, people think, well, we're too big.
Mm-hmm.
First they think, well, no competitor can take us out.
Mm-hmm.
Then the antitrust rules change and maybe a competitor can take you out. then, you know, there's a kind of a, well, we're pretty big, so, you know, it would be hard for somebody to take us over. Well, then it turns out that, you know, there's huge amounts of money to be raised,
mm-hmm.
in the junk bond market,
right.
and so money is not an obstacle. And so then we get into the phase, and I'm going to get fuzzy on the years on this because I think this process continues on into the early 90s. But
mm-hmm.
then, you know, companies adopt poison pills.
Mm-hmm.
Staggered boards,
mm-hmm.
during this time period. You know, there were always, you know, there was never a specific threat to
mm-hmm.
Monsanto of being taken over. But people, you know, people realized that
mm-hmm.
there was, you know, maybe. In those days, There were three big German chemical companies: Herxt, BASF, and Bayer.
Mm-hmm.
All three of them were bigger than Monsanto, and they were bigger than anybody else in the chemical industry in the United States except DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, people would say, "Well, you think the Germans will take us over?" Well, they never did. Okay. Mm-hmm. For whatever, who knows why. Mm-hmm. But that was always in the back of people's minds. Where here's these three big German chemical companies. They're way bigger than we are. They have huge financial resources because they've been very conservatively managed. Mm-hmm. And are they coming? Well, they never came. it would be was involved in a transaction with one of them, but none of them. I mean, their attitude was, well, no. Why would we have acquired you? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But one share, one vote. I had forgotten about that one.
Yeah, I was just curious because in some of the folks that I've talked to see it as a serious shareholder democracy, and some people said, well, that didn't matter to us at all. And I was just curious.
I don't think it was ever much of an issue.
Okay. So
there was that. Wasn't that the? I haven't thought about that for a long time. There was the SEC Rule 19C4, mm-hmm. which was ultimately invalidated by the D.C. Court mm-hmm. of Appeals, right?
Right. Yeah. But it was because the stock exchange had tried to change its listing requirements away from one share, one vote. And, some people said that, they need to do this to be competitive.
Well, there were some companies that had historical different classes mm-hmm. of voting and whatnot. And then there were a few that adopted them as mm-hmm. as anti-takeover devices. I mean, I think from the perspective of a Monsanto at that time, that was kind of a fringe issue.
Okay.
It just wasn't significant.
Okay. I wanted to jump back and get, because it's, what year, when did you start getting involved with the corporate secretary? You became corporate secretary in the 80s?
No, actually, I wasn't. I wasn't corporate secretary until the 90s.
Okay, but you were involved in.
But I was involved in it.
Okay,
I was the event. At some point, I became within the law department. I became the head of the group uh-huh. that was responsible for corporate stuff. Uh-huh. Okay, reporting to the general counsel.
Okay,
I mean there were kind of two of us. There was one guy who was in charge of litigation and environmental, mm-hmm. and there was me who was in charge of mm-hmm. corporate transactional and all the kind of stray stuff like mm-hmm. real estate and labor and that sort of thing. But I guess that was when did I become head of that group? 84, maybe something okay. like that.
And so, when you come into that position, what are some of the things that you're dealing with? Is it the same sort of things? Obviously the reporting goes on.
Yeah, the annual cycle stuff goes mm-hmm. on. The financings become more frequent mm-hmm. and more sophisticated. There's a big acquisition in 85 that triggers a lot of financing activity. Mm-hmm. It, not to mention the acquisition itself. There's a lot of divestitures. There's a lot of, this was fairly typical of Monsanto, but others in the industry at the time. There's a lot of divestitures going on all through this time period.
What do the acquisitions and divestitures, how does the governance work on that in terms of when you acquire a company, how does sort of merging their governance with that of Monsanto work? Or does it Monsanto just take over the...
Well, on most of the acquisitions, we just took it over.
Okay.
Okay. Now, there was and everybody just became subject to the Monsanto rule. Mm-hmm. Okay. There was a slight modification to that when we acquired Searle in 1985. Mm-hmm. because there was a desire on the part of the management to kind of run those businesses and leave them because mm-hmm. it was thought they were very different.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really two different businesses. It was Searle, the old pharmaceutical business, and it was NutraSweet,
mm-hmm.
which at the time, while it was on patent, was a big revenue and big profit mm-hmm. generator. But there was a desire to kind of keep them, from a management standpoint, separate.
Okay.
So I think they had their own. In terms of compliance, did they sign the Monsanto stuff or did they have their own stuff? I don't remember.
Okay.
But there couldn't have been much difference, okay, because mm-hmm. we weren't going to stand for having a totally, you know. In the chemical industry, there's always been, I think, most of the companies had pretty high level of control and mm-hmm. pretty strong attention to making sure that everybody was, you know, on track. You didn't have. I don't remember seeing, and I'm not just talking about Monsanto, mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing a lot of sort of rogue operations pop up in the chemical industry from about 1980 on. Earlier on there may have been some, but not from then on.
And it's the same sort of procedures for both domestic and international.
Yeah. The international is the tough one on that compliance stuff mm-hmm. because both from a practical standpoint, you've got all these, you know, crooked politicians in these countries who mm-hmm. have their hands out.
Mm-hmm.
And not that we don't have crooked politicians here, but, you know, you got better, better, you know, some of your employees don't really believe that you really mean it. So it's tougher to make this work correctly outside the U.S., although it's not impossible. And requires a lot of work, but
yeah.
you can do it.
Yeah.
Plus, I think, you know, some of the people in other parts of the world have gotten used to the fact that, you know, trying to jerk money out of U.S. public companies probably gets a negative answer most of the time.
Yeah. So you had acquisitions, divestitures. What other what were some of the other things you were dealing with as sort of head of the side of the law department?
Well, interestingly, in 80-81, this is, I think, fairly early on mm-hmm. as these things go, the board commissioned a study, a governance study, and there was an older lawyer who was near retirement and who was well respected and inside the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so they his name was Rod Harris, and they said, okay, we want Rod to go out and, you know, privately interview all the directors,
mm-hmm.
you know, on a, you know, and not to report back any names or anything like that, but to consolidate the thinking of all the directors on a one-on-one basis. And then go talk to various other luminaries in the field in those days, and come back with some recommendations on governance. And
mm-hmm.
I got picked to be the number two
okay.
on that effort. And we did quite a comprehensive study on governance. Came back with various recommendations for changes in how, to some extent, making the selection of directors less informal,
mm-hmm.
Some changes in committees, I think that 80-81 was pretty early to be kind of doing that.
Was there something that prompted it, or was it just something the board felt
in? No, it was, it really, it, they... It was really. I don't know who was the instigator of it amongst the directors. I don't. If I ever knew, I don't remember. But there was a general agreement that the guy who was the CEO at that time, you know, he never resisted this sort mm-hmm. of stuff. He was supportive of it.
Okay. one of the other major factors in the 80s is sort of the rise of the institutional investor.
Yes.
What influence did that have at Monsanto?
Depends on what time period you're talking. Okay. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I told you that I'll give you a story from the probably middle 80s, maybe early 80s. I told you that in the early days of, you know, starting in the 70s and all through the early 80s, the shareholder proposals, we always got them, but they were always social, political in nature. They weren't substantive on governance or anything that the company was doing. All right. A fairly large holder at that time of Monsanto stock, big enough to get the attention of the investor relations people, was either CalPERS or CalSTRS. I can't remember which one. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, I think those funds now are pretty much just index funds. I mean, they have some investments on the side and certain things, but, you know, they're so big that they're basically index funds, I guess. Plus, they must have holdings outside the U.S. as well. Anyhow, okay, but this is, you know, early 80s, all right? And, you know, they've been sending in South Africa shareholder proposals, and then I don't know if it was the fund or the legislature passed a South Africa divestment requirement. And the investor relations, but right after this was adopted, the investor relations guy thought that they would be dumping Monsanto stock. They didn't. Their holdings increased. So he goes out to California, to Sacramento, to talk to the guy and, you know, say, try to figure out what's going on and is there anything we can do to help avoid this divestment requirement. And the guy at CalPERS or CalSTRS says, oh, no, don't worry about it. No, there's nothing you can do to avoid it. But what I'm doing is I'm loading up on your stock so that when the divestment requirement kicks in, I'll just be pushed back to where I wanted to be anyhow. True story. Okay? Actually happened. So that was, you know, that's kind of institutional investors in those days. There was never anybody who had such a large, I mean, there were various of the major fund managers who took fairly substantial positions, but it was extremely rare that we ever had anybody that got to the 5% level to where you had to disclose them.
Okay.
In the proxy statement, okay?
Uh-huh.
You know, rarely one of the big fund managers would just creep over the top of the 5% thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there wasn't anybody at that point who was ever... and really, I think that's a true statement about Monsanto right up until the late 90s when the company is totally thrown up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
There's an active investor relations program, but there's never anybody who acquires the kind of large position where, you know, everybody gets really nervous. So that just wasn't our issue.
So, okay. Now, you said that the way that institutional investors change depending on when you're talking about in the 80s, so you didn't see that much of a shift in terms of how what they were looking to do?
No.
Okay.
No. We really, I mean, you know, the interface that the investor relations people had with them would be on issues like, well, we think your strategy to do X is good, or we think it's terrible, or whatever. Okay. You know, they would have, you know, and you know, you really are not getting. We're not getting strictly governance oriented proposals at that point.
Okay. A little bit later, you start seeing the rise of the professional governance services, the ISS,
right.
I guess the USA is a little bit different, but they start to try to influence, start to exercise what they see as reforming efforts in governance. Did you ever deal with them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, quite a bit, because as the years went by, starting in the early 90s, mm-hmm. the percent of the vote that they effectively, their recommendation effectively would swing, kept going up and up and up,
mm-hmm.
continuously. And
is that because the institutional investors listen to them?
Well, look, everybody that I ever talked to among institutional investors ultimately would say, in most of the voting decision, most of the annual meetings, most of the voting decisions had no real economic impact.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get paid for good voting. We get paid for good stock performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we'll, you know, except for a few of the really largest ones that tried to do this in-house, most of the fund managers, their attitude was, nobody's paying us for a voting process.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to get it done as cheaply as we possibly can. And the cheapest way to get it done is, we'll just do whatever ISS says.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the years went by, the institutional investors basically did less and less independent analysis of it, and more of them were swung by ISS, or to a lesser extent, who's the outfit in California? Glass Lewis.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they're in California. Maybe I've got that wrong. But anyhow, I mean, look, yes, ISS becomes progressively more and more significant, and you can track it in the votes. And the way you can, a way that we could track it was periodically, ISS would make just a huge mistake in their mm-hmm. recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Because they use a lot of seasonal help during the season. Many of them are inexperienced. They don't really understand what's going on. They don't know the difference between asking for approval of an incentive plan for 162M purposes versus asking for it because you need it on fundamental issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, I mean, I'll give you an example. This is about early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Monsanto had three incentive plans up for shareholder approval.
Mm-hmm.
The plans were identical, but they covered different parts of the company, and there were reasons for wanting to do them separate, have mm-hmm. a separate plan for each of these three parts of the company. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I think they were only for 162M approval purposes that they were being floated up. Now, you could logically be against all three of them or for all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you could not logically be in favor of one and against the other two, or vice versa. That's what ISS's recommendation was. They were in favor of two and against one. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was no rational way you could come to that position. So that's how we knew. You know, we knew how much of the vote they swung
mm-hmm.
because you had all these people out there that just did whatever they said.
Mm-hmm.
So that you saw what the delta was between the two. That's how you knew. And over time, you know, that and those kind of mistakes would show up periodically, and you could track that pretty accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, over time, you could see that the percentage that they were swinging was going up all the time. I don't know what people say now. You know, when mm-hmm. I kind of stopped following this closely, it was certainly up around 25%, maybe 30%.
Okay.
So, You know, and the, I mean, eventually we'll come back, I guess, to talking about the role of the society. The society, you know, worked on the SEC for years to try to get them to focus in on this, because the ISS makes these mistakes. Unless you're a really big company, there's no way to get them corrected. It's just impossible. You know, we kept saying, you know, this is a big part of the scheme. You got to do something, and they never did anything. So, I mean, I understand why there are reasons why it's difficult for them to do something, but you know, this is a it's a kind of a big logical gap in the whole system, in my opinion.
Well, so that was where I was gonna ask next is. About when did you start getting involved in the Society of Corporate Secretaries?
Oh, that's it's about 83, 84.
And what led you to start working with them?
Well, the Monsanto Law Department had a long history of involvement with the Society of Corporate Secretaries, also with the ABA.
Okay,
but. You know, I guess I was the, when I became chairman, I was the fourth person who had a Monsanto background to have been chairman of the society. And so we'd had people who had been active, and this gentleman that I talked to about, mentioned to you earlier, Rod Harris, he had been a chairman, a general counsel back in the, and secretary back in the 70s had been a chairman. The guy who was the general counsel all during the 80s and early 90s was chairman at one point. So, you know, we just had a kind of a long, you know, I mean, it was just kind of a long connection with the organization, number, you know, for I guess you could say, a couple of different reasons. One, you know, it gave you an entree at the SEC that was beneficial in terms of your work for Monsanto, in terms of knowing the people there, and knowing who to call if you had a problem and that sort of thing, and people at the SEC being willing to talk to you. Also, you know, you kind of felt like you were giving better advice inside if you knew what the thinking was directionally at the SEC.
Okay.
You know, and so, you know, it was just kind of, I mean, they were, you know, the organization never questioned supporting it. Okay.
Right.
It's just part of some of the thing, you know, some of the things we just did.
So were you primarily involved in the Securities Law Committee?
Yes. Yes, and ultimately chairman of that committee.
Right. And so with that committee, you have a pretty significant amount of involvement with the SEC.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, at the beginning, and I can't remember exactly when it changed, but, you know, we were one of very few groups that had two meetings with the SEC every year. One in the fall, late fall, which would sort of be in anticipation of the proxy season, and then one in the spring after it was over, which was a sort of a postmortem on the on the proxy season. And the one in the spring was actually a meeting with the commissioners.
Okay.
The one in the fall was with CorpFin and any other one of the divisions that was relevant to whatever we were talking about that year, Market Reg or whomever. And then in the spring, it would be a commission meeting. It would actually be a meeting of the commissioners. At some point, someone concluded that, I don't know if there was a change in the Sunshine Law or they just rethought it, but they decided, well, it couldn't be a commission meeting. And so we would have a meeting, and the commissioners would come in seriatim. You know, one would come in and listen for a while, and then he or she would go out, and the next one would come in. So it couldn't be a meeting, okay? I can't remember what the rule was. Maybe two of them could be in the room at the same time, and it wasn't a meeting. But if three were, it was a meeting. I you know.
But basically, we had these had really, I think, pretty productive meetings with them on this twice a year basis for as long as, I mean, it was going on before I was involved, and it continued after I was involved. And our focus in those meetings was always to try to focus our comments on, to the greatest extent possible, on practical issues, mechanical issues, communication issues, if you will, you know, to focus on the nuts and bolts of how you execute all these rules, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was also involved to a much lesser extent with the ABA committees that wrote, you know, were involved in these this kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
The ABA letters tended to be more like law review pieces. They were superb analyses of the law, and you know, they were at a higher level, if you will, in the sense of overview. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, our letters and the comments that we had at these meetings, we tried to say, look, you know, there's a practical problem with your proposed rule for whatever. Here's why.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something you could do differently that would solve the practical problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we had considerable, you know, if you go back, again, talking about this 80s into the early 90s period, I think that comment process was influential in terms of changing the way the SEC approached benefit plans in the S-8. That was a huge waste of time the way it was done before on everybody's part. I think we've had quite a bit of impact on the changes to Section 16 rules in 91 or 2, mm-hmm. whenever that was. And as each one of these cycles of the compensation disclosure, I think we had considerable influence on it. And also because this is a group that was tended to be people from law departments of large issuers, there was always a lot of discussion about shareholder proposals because mm-hmm. these were the companies that were the targets of the shareholder proposals, both in the old days when they were mostly social, political proposals, and then later on when they became kind of governance, or more governance-oriented. I haven't seen statistics recently, but, you know, for a long time, once you got below Fortune, certainly below Fortune 100, maybe even not much below Fortune 50, shareholder proposals pretty much disappeared. I mean, if you went and had a discussion with a lot of mid-cap people, they'd say, you know, don't bore us with this. It's not an issue.
Sure.
Because they didn't get shareholder proposals. Now, I don't know what the numbers are now because I haven't followed it as closely lately. And there's probably more, but, you know, it's still mostly a big company phenomenon.
Is it because the gadflies focus on the big companies?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Well, and I think there's a sense on the part of the proponents, there's a sense that if they can get a household name
mm-hmm.
to either have the shareholders vote for their proposals or maybe they negotiate something,
mm-hmm.
okay, that
right.
has a lot more impact than getting some, you know, $500 million company somewhere that nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
You know, they agree, so what?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the focus of those was always on the bigger companies, and the Securities Law Committee tended to be within the society, it was weighted towards the larger companies, not because it was a policy to do it that way. It just that's those are the people who tended to want to get involved in this.
Were there particular individuals at the SEC with whom you had good work, particularly good working
relationships? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I try, you know, I thought about that. I'm going to forget people. But, you know, people that over the years that we had really good relationships were, you know, Bill Morley, Linda Quinn, Brian Lane, Maury Osheroff, bless her heart, Elise Walter when she was in the staff. I mean, I don't like her as a commissioner. I mean, I think Elise is, you know, really, really superb. You know, among the commissioners, you know, the Ed Fleischman and Steve Wallman were always very receptive to hearing what we had to say, what the society had to say. I'm going to forget some people that I should have named, but those are, you know, among the staff, Bill Morley, Linda Quinn, Brian Lane, Maury Osheroff, Elise Walter, they were terrific. But there were, you know, there's a bunch more, and I should remember Wallman as commissioner. He's one of these guys who's got a mind that's so fast. Just amazing to watch him work because he was really quick. You know, people we had trouble with, Breeden, never could get much of, you know, mileage with him. The other guy who was a chairman that I thought was always very receptive to listening to us, and you know, it doesn't mean they have to do what you say. It just, you know, do they listen? Do they understand? Was Dave Reuter, who was chairman. And Levitt was, I mean, we had a little less to dealing with him, but I never thought he was hostile. I will make a general comment that up until the time of Sarbanes-Oxley and all this other stuff that starts after the, you know, in the kind of early 2000s, I never thought it made any significant difference whether the Democrats or the Republicans were in the White House or in control of Congress. It was a very apolitical operation. I mean, I always thought that everybody that I ever dealt with there during that period was focused on, you know, how can we organize this for the best result? Okay, and recognizing we've got different constituencies. We got various people that we have to listen to, and we can't satisfy all of them. But at least I thought up until that time, it was a very apolitical process focused on getting a good result. Okay? Since Sarbanes-Oxley, it's obviously been very much politicized. You never had split votes in the commission before that time where, you know, the Republicans lined up on one side and the Democrats on the other side. In the Bill Donaldson years, actually Donaldson was supposedly the Republican, but he was voting with the Democrats. Now, you know, I mean, it just became much more like many of the rest of the Washington agencies, in that, you know, they were always looking over their shoulder at what Congress was going to do or some critical. Sure. It's not that Congress had no influence on them before, but they, you know, they didn't. The agency really kind of stood off by itself, you know, they really. I don't think I never saw any influence that they were subject to a lot of political pressure. That's not true for the last 10, 12 years. They're under a lot of political pressure. I mean, I'll tell you what I think was the turning point. It was the turning point in my mind, not necessarily the turning point in reality, okay? Sometime in his first term, George W. Bush gives a speech in which he, I don't remember to what audience, but it wasn't particularly a business or a market audience, in which he talks about the need to change the accounting for stock options.
Okay.
I thought, I know there's this issue about accounting for stock options. I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined that it would have risen to the level where the President of the United States felt compelled to say something about it.
Right.
You know, yeah. Pretty technical issue.
Yeah.
You know, obviously somebody's written this into the President's speech and thinks he needs to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, that to me was a sign that, you know, the political landscape for the SEC and for the whole governance area had, you know, shifted in a very fundamental
way. And that's after Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember when he says it. It's contemporaneous with Sarbanes-Oxley or right after or something. I don't know.
Right.
But, I mean, it's inconceivable that you would have had, name any prior president, who would have, presidents never addressed these issues,
right.
Okay. I mean, they talk about the economy, you know, or, you know, people periodically go on a vendetta against Wall Street or that sort of thing. But,
right.
But you know, to focus in on a narrow technical right. issue like this.
Yeah, descending into the nuts and bolts.
That's yeah. different.
Uh-huh.
That's different. And, of course, everything since then, you know, Congress has, you know, passed, obviously, you know, two sets of major legislation and gotten very involved in
mm-hmm.
setting very specific rules in areas that the commission used to handle by regulation.
Right.
Much more from the standpoint of issuer and issuer's counsel, the old way was a lot better. Because you could have some influence. It's very
right.
difficult. I mean, look, I think the society has been was a constructive force and source of information when we were dealing mm-hmm. with the commission, and that the commission was responsive to what we said. Not that they did everything we asked for, but
right.
you don't expect that. You know, once Congress is involved, it's out of, you know, you've lost control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, I don't think we, you know, very difficult to have much impact on that process.
Mm-hmm. So,
short of, I mean, you know, I mean, every so often the Chamber of Commerce threatens litigation or something
mm-hmm.
like that, but I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, I just, you know, it was just, I think, a more productive process, but it is what it is.
Because it's easier to have give and take with an agency than it
yeah.
is with 535
yeah.
members of
yeah,
Congress.
No, that's right, and you know, anyhow, okay, well, you know, it's too bad. I think that separation from the, you know, day-to-day political process that the commission enjoyed was a reason why they were always on the list of most admired government
mm-hmm.
agencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, nobody thought they were out. You know, everybody thought, well, they're just trying to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
And, so, the issues that you were dealing with then were benefits plans, Section 16. And like you said, in the early 90s, there's a revival of executive compensation. And
yeah, there's another cycle on executive comp.
Mm-hmm. Is there something driving these things, or is this just what the commission's interested in, do you think?
No, I mean, it's a combination of... pressure from certain groups that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, that think that they're being somehow unfairly dealt with.
Okay. And then, so you were president or chairman of the society in 99?
Yes, 98 to 99.
What were the major issues that you were contending with at that point?
You know, it was pretty much a continuation of the, I mean, in many respects, you know, you can say that was the good old days. before we had to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley.
Right.
To some extent, it's the Stone Age of corporate governance at this point. Because we did not... you know, we hadn't had the Enron, WorldCom scandals and all the rest of that stuff that generated Sarbanes-Oxley and all. I mean, there was continuous... I mean, the issues we had at that time were the ones that we had right along,
mm-hmm.
which is Now, the whole proxy process, you know, we were involved, we had been involved for some time in discussions with both the stock exchange and the SEC about the voting process. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some gaps in the voting process that, depending on what it was, maybe the SEC could solve it, or maybe the stock exchange mm-hmm. could solve it, but they would have to have the SEC with them, and so ISS was at issue then, and the whole there were still takeover issues, so mm-hmm. it was pretty much in '99 it was pretty much the same agenda, you know. One thing that I tried to do my year as chairman, mm-hmm. which I didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect was kind of prophetic. I tried to get the organization to we didn't have much of a Washington presence. We had an active member who was in Washington, and if somebody needed to go represent the society at some meeting of whomever, whatever mm-hmm. group, he would do it for us. Well, he retired.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have anybody. And so I said we need to pay somebody to be our representative. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, we should have done it a couple of years before that, and maybe we would have had some greater presence for purposes of the Sarbanes-Oxley process, but
mm-hmm.
maybe not.
Okay.
Anyhow, that I thought, and we did in fact hire somebody mm-hmm. to be our man in Washington, but it never had the kind of impact that I hoped it would. Maybe that's just the nature of the process.
Was there any? This is in that time is when Arthur Levitt starts first discussing the auditor independence issue. Did you deal with that at all in your time as president or chairman?
No, I don't think that was that really was. I mean, we knew about it, but that really wasn't a big issue.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't really become an issue until 2000, but he started talking about it in, I think, the fall of 98.
Yeah. Fall of when?
I think 98.
Is he? Okay.
I think his numbers game speech is September 98, maybe November. But things don't really get moving until, I think, 2000. So.
Well, you know, I don't know what other people are telling you. My perception on auditor independence is, you know, that Sarbanes-Oxley is the greatest gift to the auditors that's come along in a long time, because up until that point, my sense is that the audit firms were using the audit process as a loss leader to get the consulting business.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an idea that's original with me. A lot of people mm-hmm. have said this, okay? I mean, am I privy to their numbers and I know this? No, of course not. But it sure looked like it.
Uh-huh.
And out of this whole, I guess you can say one beneficial part of the whole Enron and Sarbanes-Oxley thing was that all shifted. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think the audit is a loss leader.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the audits are expensive,
right.
and nobody gives you a break on them. and clearly they've that whole process has tightened up somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
You can argue about whether you should have auditor rotation or not, but
mm-hmm.
I think the more whether you did that or not, it's not going to have the kind of fundamental shift that we saw in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because it became important to everybody that the auditors put more horsepower
mm-hmm.
into the audit process,
and
obviously, you know, you add to that the requirement for the audit to include this review of internal controls, and the whole thing gets, you know, much bigger,
right.
and so on.
To go back to...
But that, I don't recall that being something that we were, perhaps wrongly, we should have been focusing on, but I don't think we were when I was, during my time.
Around the same time, or a little bit before that, you went with Solutia when it was spun off from Monsanto.
Yeah, the old Monsanto was kind of blown up in pieces.
Okay. I mean,
what happened over a period of about 3 years... the old Monsanto had kind of four businesses.
Mm-hmm.
The chemical business, which had been the original core.
Mm-hmm.
The ag business, which at that time was more herbicides than seeds, but it was shifting more towards seeds. The Searle pharmaceutical business.
Mm-hmm.
And then NutraSweet, which was kind of, by then, the patent. We're getting to the end of the patent. And it's starting to decline in terms of size. And then there were a few stray businesses, odds and ends. And there was a management decision that the chemical business, being historically cyclical,
mm-hmm.
was so different from the pharmaceutical business and the ag business that they should separate. And so I don't know if it was the first or the second transaction was the spin-off of the chemical business as Solutia. NutraSweet and some of these stray businesses are divested about that time. And what remains merges with a company called Pharmacia and Upjohn, which is a pharmaceutical company.
Okay.
Pharmacia and Upjohn, and I may have the sequence on this. I may not have the sequence exactly right. Pharmacia and Upjohn people are effectively in control, and they have no interest in the ag business.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start the process to spin off the ag business. Somewhere, and I'm not sure I'm getting the sequence exactly right, but it's all within a fairly short period mm-hmm. of time. Within the pharmaceutical business of Monsanto, which is now part of Pharmacia and Upjohn, which is the company is just called Pharmacia at that point,
mm-hmm.
there's a new drug called Celebrex, which, as people had thought, turns out to be a blockbuster drug. And Pfizer becomes interested in owning Celebrex. And so Pfizer buys Pharmacia.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's after the Pfizer acquisition that the spinoff of ag is completed.
Okay.
But I may have the sequence wrong.
Okay.
You know, I thought I'd never forget that stuff, but, you know,
sure.
After a while. And so the company that's called Monsanto now, today, is the old ag division of the old Monsanto, and it has been very successful. They really have the best technology in that genetically modified seed business. The pharmaceutical business is part of Pfizer. Solutia was spun off and was recently acquired by Eastman Chemical.
Okay.
And the other strays, I've lost track of.
Okay.
I don't know what happened to them.
Okay.
But they're not very big.
It
represented I ended up being going off with the chemical business as general counsel and secretary.
Okay. And that gave you a chance to sort of put in a whole, not a whole new form, but to build a new governance.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I would wish that was one of the happiest things that ever happened to me. Because all of a sudden, you can ditch all the stuff that you all these years thought was pointless and start from scratch and just do the stuff that you think is really worth doing.
Uh-huh.
And I mean,
there's a couple of things. I had the CEO of Solutia was a guy named Bob. I mean, not was, he's still alive. A guy named Bob Potter, who was just terrific, and you know, and wanted, you know, again, I couldn't ask for anybody more supportive of what I was trying to do. And we both said, you know, we can have good governance, but we can simplify this. And so, you know, things, the way the board was constituted was there were three directors that came over from the Monsanto board.
Okay.
Because the Monsanto board got split in the process. And I think we got three. Or four. I guess it was four. We weren't going to have anybody except the CEO as a board member, so that Bob was going to be a director. And then, so we had to go out and we had to find people, okay? And with one exception, who was who had been the CEO of a company here in St. Louis, and somebody that Bob Potter knew and wanted, he wanted him. The rest of them we kind of got by talking to the other outside directors or through Headhunter. And so it was a fairly systematic process. And, you know, we kind of said, well, we need another finance guy because the finance guy that we got from Monsanto is getting to retirement age. We're going to lose him, so we need another finance guy.
Right.
And, you know, we need a couple of CEOs, and we need, you know, and so we had, you know, and we had the existing directors, you know, just talk to them. And so we set up a board of 10, including the one insider. Major change from old Monsanto in terms of the quality of the discussion that went on in the board meeting. Now, I have heard business school professors talk about this phenomenon, and I think there's a fair amount of academic research on it. But somewhere around 12, people clam up. When you get above, when you get up more than 12 or so directors, people clam up. We saw this in, you know, Monsanto had a big board. Plus, there were a lot, while there weren't a lot of inside directors, there were a lot of insiders who were allowed to sit through most of the meeting. Okay, vice presidents in charge of major divisions. And, you know, it was a big room. There were probably 25 people in the room. All right. Well, we got that with the solution. We got down to 10 people in the room. The quality of the discussion and the questions that were asked went way up.
Okay.
And as I say, I have read, heard academics who have, you know, researched this and documented that that's what happens. Above some number, and I'm going to say it's 12, but, you know, maybe it's 13 or I don't know.
Right.
Somewhere around there, people, even if they're big names with big resumes, clam up. They don't talk, and they don't ask questions. And so, you know, the major step forward that I felt we made in terms of governance was shrinking the number of people in the room. Had a, you know, I mean, the quality of the discussion was so much better than it was in the old Monsanto boardroom. I just, it was just day and night. You know, I mean, we did all the other things that you were supposed to do from a governance standpoint, but that was by far the most dramatic thing we did, was say it's going to be 10, you know, and except maybe for a short transition period, it's never going to be more than 10.
And mostly, almost all independent folks.
Yeah, all. I mean, as I say, there were a couple who came to us in the breakup of Monsanto. There were a couple that came to that were, I think 1, 2, 3, I think it was three, or maybe there was a fourth one. Maybe. Uh-huh. But anyhow, less than half. Okay, and we found the rest of them. I mean, like I said, being able to go through that spin-off process, chunk all the stuff that I thought was a waste of time. I mean, the other thing that we did at the same time, which is a different governance issue and not one that interests anybody particularly, we shrunk the number of subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, old Monsanto had something like 200 subsidiaries. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We got it down to 23, something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, most of them outside the United States, where for local legal reasons you had to have something. Okay?
Right.
I mean, the finance guy that I was working with on that project, that part of it, said, he ran the numbers. He said each subsidiary, on average, is costing us $100,000 a year to do nothing, okay,
yeah.
Except be there.
Right.
So, you know, there's a major shift like that opens the door to all kinds of improvements that you can make in terms of, all big institutions end up doing a lot of things just because they've always done them that way.
Did the directors who'd come over from Monsanto ever comment on the difference?
Oh, yeah. No, they were all... did they ever comment on
it? I mean, just didn't know if it was something like, wait, they went, wow, you know, this guy...
Oh, no. I don't know that I ever heard one say that. Okay. All right.
They just opened up more.
Well, they just opened up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, even there was one fellow who rarely said anything in Monsanto. You know, when we got him, all of a sudden he started talking. I mean, it just, and anyhow.
So besides the
that was, I mean, that but that for me that was really really fortunate to be able to start from scratch again.
Were there any other experiences that you had at Munson and you thought, gee, you know, I'm gonna do something different at Solutia? Smaller board, fewer subsidiaries, fewer committees.
Yeah, ratchet down the number of committees because committees. The other reason is, I mean, staffing committees takes a lot of time and is ultimately fairly expensive. So if you can ratchet down the number of committees, I mean. One, the only place I sort of got to where the chairman and I were at opposite ends, I said, I want an executive committee. I'm not going to ask them to do anything important, but there's routine crap that comes along that you don't really want to bother the whole board with. Well, he'd been an outside director on another board, and he'd been on the executive committee, and he'd had a terrible experience. So he said, no, we are not having an executive committee. Okay, chief. Whatever you say, we'll do it. But you know, he would. You know, we expanded the scope of the three committees we had, basically. And by gosh, you know, one of the three dealt with everything that we had dealt with.
And the committees were
audit and finance. Actually, I think we just called it the audit committee. Comp, governance.
Gotcha. Which, so you have, that's 97, 98?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so it's really 96, 97.
Okay. So you have that structure you set up, and then a few years down the road comes Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah.
How did that change? Did it change the way that you all...
Well, it made the, you know, my observation is that what I saw was that the directors became much more defensive or had much more, I mean, I'll give you a practical example, okay? Uh-huh. Prior to Sarbanes-Oxley, I would take the,
you know, I would have a review of the D&O insurance with the governance committee once a year, and less frequently with the full board, okay?
D&O, directors and officers.
Directors and officers insurance, all right? After that, the governance committee wanted to talk about D&O insurance at every meeting we ever had, and the board wanted to hear about it a lot, too. And it was just because they naturally got nervous.
Sure.
And they wanted to be sure that we had done whatever we could reasonably do to make sure that the insurance was as good as it could be. And that's one example. But otherwise, I think in general, and I've heard this from other people in other companies, the directors became more... less focused on the business and more focused on looking over their shoulders to make sure somebody wasn't chasing them. The practical result is if people are worried about D&O insurance, you're spending the limited time you have in the board meeting talking about D&O insurance, you're not talking about the business.
Mm-hmm.
It's only so many hours you got. That's... As I say, other people have told me they saw that too. You know, people understandably, directors understandably, outside directors I'm talking about, became more focused on what they had to do to protect themselves and spent less time on the business. Not that they did nothing about the business, but that, you know.
Right.
The ratio of time spent on these topics changed.
Sarbanes-Oxley have a major impact on how you view your responsibilities as corporate secretary.
No, it just expanded the number of things you had to do.
Okay.
You got all the things you've been doing, and here's a bunch more that you're going to do now.
So, just expanded your responsibilities.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't... I didn't feel like it ever, you know, that you just had to do more. That's all. I mean, I never felt it changed my relationship with the directors or anything like that.
David Smith talked a little bit about it. It's sort of the impetus within the society for... the idea, really popularizing the idea of the governance professional. Do you have any thoughts about
that? David really what shall I say, in many ways he's the author of that concept. That, you know, governance has become a, whatever you want to say, a field unto itself or whatever. And that there are people who spend most of their time on these issues and have become governance professionals, and it includes the corporate secretary, but there are other people out there, obviously outside counsel. But I'll tell you where I, you know, for better or worse, there is, in the wake of Sarbanes-Oxley, you had all these requirements which, with I think one exception, applied only to public companies. But it got so much attention that it kind of crept over into the private company, and even more so into the non-profit area. And you had these concepts that, I know a number of people who are consultants to non-profits, and they essentially, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley was a godsend for them because they could go out and advise these nonprofits that now you ought to do all this Sarbanes-Oxley stuff, and here's what you should do, and so on and so forth. So there certainly was created a lot more governance professionals, some of whom knew most of whom knew what they were doing. Some didn't. And it was just a marketing tool, but
in the nonprofit world, I thought. But, yeah, I mean, some companies have adopted a title of chief governance officer or something like that. And you know, the whole thing has become more institutionalized. In many companies, there's an institutional connection to the whole compliance process, mm-hmm. And what's changed, I suppose, is that you have people who a lot more people who are focused on governance,
mm-hmm.
and you have governance perceived as a whole area or unto itself, whereas mm-hmm. I think if you go back to the early days, there were governance changes, but nobody, it was, well, okay, it's time to get rid of all these inside directors, that's not right, we shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just, you know, it was kind of a single episodic
right.
sort of thing, whereas now I think you've got, you know, governance viewed as a whole area of knowledge or learning or
right.
whatever you want to call it.
Well, Sarbanes-Oxley moves governance, I don't know if I want to say forward, but it moves it on a number of different fronts.
Yes. So
it's not just one episodic change, it's movement on a whole number
yeah,
of issues.
Yeah, and my point is it has an impact well beyond the domestic public companies that it was specifically
mm-hmm.
aimed at.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody 20 years ago nobody talked about governance.
Right.
Okay. Now everybody talks about governance. Okay.
Governance is an umbrella term for a number of things that we talked about individually before.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. I guess in the past you dealt with proxy access or independent directors or just as they came up. And
yeah,
it's all...
I don't know. I'm not sure I can remember exactly when it all becomes lumped under the governance umbrella, but at some point it does.
Uh-huh.
So,
were there any other there's Sarbanes-Oxley, while you're at Solutia, are there other governance issues that stand out in your memory? Or other governance things that you dealt with?
Oh, well, there was a kind of a continuous stream of stuff. I had the compliance responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some of the stuff we dealt with were compliance issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did all the things that the Sarbanes-Oxley required and
mm-hmm.
all that, but in terms of the reality of governance, the biggest change we made was shrinking the size of the board and how many people got to sit in the room. Big difference.
Well, it's just, it probably keeps groupthink from setting in, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, as I say, I you know, there's a phenomenon which I is apparently documented in the academic work
right.
that groups behave differently depending on the size.
Right.
So I mean, that's why in the not-for-profit world, you can point to any number of examples of these not-for-profits that have gotten into trouble, and they got into trouble because they had ineffective boards. Why was the board ineffective? Because it had 55 people on it or something like that. That was the American Red Cross. I heard a presentation at a society meeting by a woman who was a governance professional. I can't remember what mm-hmm. her title was. And she was at the American Red Cross. And they went through this scandal. And they had a board of 50-ish,
mm-hmm.
okay? And, it was totally ineffective. Nobody spoke up. Nobody, you know, how do you have a meeting that big and have
mm-hmm.
any kind of intelligent discussion? And she said,
You know, why did we do it? Well, same reason other charities have big boards. They think that if they add people, they get more donations. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, 50 people will donate more than 10. Mm-hmm. She said they had shrunk the Red Cross board from 50-ish to, I don't know, 15, something mm-hmm. like that. Total contributions from the board went up.
Huh.
Because these, whatever it was, 12, 15 people really felt committed to the organization.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. And in addition, they had a board that was really engaged
right.
and involved. But, you know, we had a, you know, there's a local St. Louis example, just been in the newspaper recently. St. Louis University, which is a Jesuit school, which has been, the president has been a man named Father Larry Biondi for years, who's done great things with the mm-hmm. school. He really has. But he's been there a long time. And, you know, he has a board of 50 or something like that. And it was, you know, there was a lot of discontent on the part of the faculty, and I don't know who's right or wrong, or if nobody's right or wrong, that's not the point. The point was it was you could just tell even from the press reports that, you know, the board wasn't really engaged mm-hmm. in any of this, which they should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, well, whatever you want to keep going on your list. I had a couple things
I was going to say, go ahead.
You know, one person that I think in terms of the history of the SEC should really have a statue in the lobby was John Shadd.
Okay.
This is really before I was, I guess maybe... Maybe when I became active in the society and went to meet the people at the SEC, he might have been at the kind of tail end of his time.
Okay.
But Shadd, to my mind, made some major important changes that were fundamental.
Okay.
Number one. He had he changed the focus of the enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that time, there was a man that you may have interviewed for this, Judge Sporkin.
Mm. He's been interviewed. I haven't interviewed
him. You haven't interviewed him. He was the director of enforcement, and he was... At least my perception was he was fond of coming up with new legal theories and going off into brand new areas. Okay, mm-hmm. And he, you know, got a lot of media attention and whatnot in the Wall Street Journal and so on. But I don't think there was much enforcement in insider trading.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I had discussions with pretty sophisticated business people. And they all knew that if they engaged in price fixing, they were going high. They had a high risk of going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
But if you presented them with an insider trading issue, many of them wouldn't even know that there was a legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't, you know.
Right.
The insider trading was not anywhere near top of mind.
Right.
Shadd changed that. He turned the focus on insider trading, and you know, then we get all of the prosecutions that come in the 80s
mm-hmm.
and continue in the 90s
right.
of the people who are engaged in insider trading. I think that was an absolutely dramatic change back to basics on
mm-hmm.
enforcement
mm-hmm.
that had a real impact on the business community.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing he did was start the computerization, which was called EDGAR.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if he wasn't the first government agency to try to computerize things, he was the second, maybe. And it was a long, slow, difficult process mm-hmm. because Monsanto volunteered to be part of the pilot program.
Okay.
And it was, you know, it was not beneficial to the company to have been in the pilot program. It was, it was very inflexible, and it was just, it was excruciating.
Mm-hmm.
But it got, you know, eventually it got
sure.
done, and it, you know, and you know, that, especially given the nature of the industry you're regulating, which has become so much, everything is moving so much faster mm-hmm. than it was 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have stayed, you know, to not to have gotten out in front of the electronic age would have been just a terrible disservice. So he deserves credit for that.
Uh-huh.
It's during his regime, and I don't know how much he had to do with this or whether others were involved, but we get finally an effort to integrate the 33 and the 34 Act.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamental change. I mean, it's many people have said that if the 34 Act had been passed before the 33 Act, we never would have had the 33 Act. Okay, that was done right. backwards.
Right.
Okay, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't think any other country has a structure like ours. Okay. You know, they all basically start with something akin to the 34 Act.
Uh-huh.
Not sure. The same, but, you know.
Right.
And so it's in this period, early 80s, when we start to get integration of the 33 and 34 Act.
Uh-huh.
Again, huge step forward in terms of eliminating, you know, just pointless paper pushing. And the fourth thing that starts then, although maybe it's later in the 80s when it really takes hold, is the SEC stops trying to review everything
uh-huh.
that's filed, okay? It starts to prioritize what it's going to review. And, in, you know, this is in parallel with the end of the S-8 as a separate, you know.
Right.
You know. So we make another huge step forward in terms of efficiency mm-hmm. without any detriment to,
sure.
to investors, and particularly with the S-8, because they aren't really investors. The money's being given to them.
Right.
Or the securities are being given to them. You know, that's... that all either starts or is initiated. You know,
uh-huh.
it starts and some of it gets pretty far along
yeah.
During Shad's regime. I think, you know, terribly important, and it has had a huge lasting impact. And
mm-hmm.
I think the guy, I mean, he's been dead for years now, but mm-hmm. I think the guy really, like I said, he should have, his statue should be in the SEC. I think he's, those were among the most, you know, yes, all this other stuff that's come subsequently on governance, but as mm-hmm. I said at the beginning, that the society, when we in our dealings with the SEC, we tried to focus on issues of practicality,
right.
efficiency,
right.
and that period is one in which we make major gains in terms of just practical administration of the statute. Another issue that I'm not really competent to talk about, but kind of fascinates me, and maybe in your, this is really perhaps beyond the, I don't know if this is within the scope of your governance project or not, but, you know, there's this big flurry of activity in 76, 77 with the questionable payments.
Mm-hmm.
And the Congress passes the Foreign Corrupt Practices
yep.
Act. And after that initial flurry, you go for about 25 years, and I don't think there's five cases that are brought under the Act. Maybe there were five.
Okay.
Okay? And then all of a sudden, there's a gush. I co-authored an article on this sometime.
Okay.
I did an article with another guy in 05 or 06 on this. There's a huge gush of cases brought. And... the historical question here is, what was going on for 25 years? and what changed? So that all of a sudden people started bringing these cases. I was just an observer, and that's what we were doing, writing this article, just saying, look, there's a whole bunch of, you know, bunch of cases here, prosecutions brought under circumstances that you might never have thought had anything to do with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, partly because everybody involved is an American, you know? Right. There's no foreigners here at all.
Right.
That's, you know, as I say, I don't know if that's within the scope of your article, but it, you know, there's an interesting kind of question there.
Sure.
What happened between 77 and kind of 2000-ish?
Yeah. That's a good question.
Those are probably the kind of things that occurred to me as I went through your list. The only other historical story I know, and I don't know if this is true, okay, but I think it's a great story, is, and maybe you've heard this from somebody else, supposedly in the 20s, Joe Kennedy would be walking down Wall Street or Boston State Street or somewhere, and he would climb up on a shoe sign stand, and he would know that the shoe shine man would say, "Mr. Kennedy, what are you buying?" And Kennedy would feed the shoeshine man three or four companies' names, knowing that the shoeshine man would tell the next customer, "Oh, let me tell you, Joe Kennedy is buying X, Y, and Z." Kennedy would go back to his office, watch these other guys go, bid the price of the stock up, and he would sell it short.
That's a great story.
I think that's a great story. I don't know if it's true or not, but it could be true.
It wouldn't surprise me.
the other Joe Kennedy story is a Chicago story.
Okay.
There's a guy in the poop by 1960 is second tier in the mafia in Chicago, right under the big boss of the mafia, whose name was Sam Giancana. Okay, the second tier mobster is always referred to in the media in Chicago as Murray the Camel Humphreys. Okay, I don't know why he was the camel, but they always called him the camel. All right, so it's the spring of 1960. April, May. Mm-hmm. And this story is being told by Mrs. the Camel, mm-hmm. who is by this time a widow. It's many years later. Mm-hmm. And she says, Murray comes home from a meeting of all of the mafia hierarchy at Giancana's house, and he's spitting tacks. He's just mad as can be. And she says, "What's wrong?" And Murray says, "I've been told I have to produce so many thousands of dollars for Jack Kennedy's campaign." And Mrs. the Camel says, "So this is Chicago. This happens every 4 years. What's new? Why are you so upset?" He says, "Do you know who this guy is? He's the son of Joe Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy is a crook. I'm not going to give him any money." Well, she says, "Well, why is he a crook?" Well, and then Murray proceeds to tell a story about how during Prohibition, he had a deal for some liquor with Joe, and Joe
didn't deliver the goods, but Murray gave him the money. So, anyhow, you know.
Those are great stories.
Great story. That one might be true because Mrs. the Camel had no reason to lie about it.
Anyhow.
Yeah. So you left Solution 2009.
2003.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, 2003. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. And what made you decide to go back into private practice?
Oh, I mean, I had kind of set a target for retiring for myself. I'm a believer in term limits.
Okay.
And I decided I'm going to term limit myself.
Gotcha.
And I just set a time and said, okay, that's it. I really think that that's beneficial for a lot of reasons to do that. And then after I retired, I was approached by a couple of law firms in town.
Uh-huh.
You know, well, would you like to come and work for us, work with us? And, you know, my answer was, yeah, but I'm not going to take on a full-time load.
Uh-huh.
No, that's okay. So I ended up with a kind of a part-time arrangement with these guys.
And sort of cases or what sort of work?
It was all in the same kind of what we've broadly called governance, but it's, you know, board-related issues, compensation-related issues, some transactional stuff too, but mostly just, you know, kind of. And plus, you know, they sent me out to speak to groups and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. And then you retired from that. That's where I got confused. You got retired from there in 2000.
Yeah.
This is just before all the Dodd-Frank stuff really kicks.
Yeah, that's right. In retrospect, I think, you know,
it's either great timing or terrible timing.
You get to a point where, well, I don't know, everybody's different. In terms of retirement, I know guys who kept going to the office into their mid 90s.
Uh-huh.
I'm not quite sure what they did, but they went to the office every day. You know, it's kind of the only thing I did that was conscious, really conscious about it, was saying, okay, the job as general counsel and secretary of solution was a terrific job. I really loved it, but I thought, you know, I'm going to give myself a time, and it's time to go.
Gotcha.
So I don't know. David says your father had been at the SEC because he thought he remembered him being at these, when we had these dinners with the with the staff.
Yep, he was the, we can talk about that after the interview if you want.
Okay.
That's all I'd like to cover. Do you have anything else to use?
No, those are the things that had occurred to me.
Okay, great. Well, it's been thank you for doing the interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
No, I hope I remembered it correctly at this point.